It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later in the hour, we'll talk about suicide prevention among college students. Did you know this? That suicide is the second leading cause of death after traffic accidents among college students. We'll check in with representatives, wellness representatives from the three public universities here in Iowa in the second half hour. First, the community of Sioux City is pushing for a detox center. This is to help those struggling with addiction and homelessness in that area. It's called the Siouxland Street Project, and it's organized by the Siouxland Human Investment Partnership. And bringing together a collaboration of community leaders, organizers, human services, law enforcement, and some others to make this detox center a reality in the future. Let's talk about it with Matt Oman, Executive Director of Siouxland Human Investment Partnership, and Frank Lemaire. He's a member of the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska, a longtime Native community advocate in that area, working to create care for Native and non-Native Siouxland community members who are struggling with addiction and homelessness. Frank Lemaire and Matt Oman, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Let me start with you, Matt Oman. What is it, the Siouxland Street Project? What is it? Why was it called into being?
So the street project was created about 2 years ago, and it was the result of a meeting that I had with Mr. Lemaire, as well as the Sioux City Police Department. And it was kind of a response to a meeting where some of the downtown businesses had gathered, and they were addressing the issue of panhandling in downtown Sioux City. We had kind of an uptick in homeless population panhandling. So there was a community meeting, and we just decided, you know, there was no nonprofits that were invited to that community meeting, but the police saw it as a big issue. Frank and the Native American community saw it as a big issue. And so that's how SHIP, my organization, became involved. We really look at filling gaps in the community. So when there are community needs that come up, we try to facilitate collaboration around those needs to kind of come up with some problem solving. So that's how that came about. It was a collaboration between my organization, SHIP, as well as Sioux City Police Department, Downtown Partners, which is kind of a collaboration of the downtown businesses, the Native American community, and Mercy Medical Center. So all of our agencies together created this initiative to compassionately deal with the homeless, the increasingly, problematic homeless issues in Sioux City.
Mm-hmm. Frank Lemaire, talk a little bit more in detail about the gap that you identified, the problem that was identified, and specifically how the Native American population in the area fit into it.
Well, you know, we have a problem, of course, everyone knows in our community with homelessness and addiction. And it is prevalent. You can see it on the streets on any given day. And it began to impact, I think, the business community. So there was interest. And I have for many years worked to try to heal Native people on many different fronts. I should point out to you that one of the reasons I do what I do in Sioux City is I was one of the architects in the effort to stop the illegal flow of alcohol from Nebraska onto Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, probably the worst-case scenario in all of North America. I worked on that for 20 years, and in the Supreme Court, we had the license taken from those four beer sellers on September 30th. So very naturally, I've been involved for a long time, but I guess I see fit if we can take it and make impact in one of the most blighted areas, we ought to be able to make impact in our own community. And that's what we sought to do. The Native community of Woodbury County, we wish to get well.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm at a place in my experience that if the Native community tells you that they're ready to get well, we ought to have an opportunity to see what we can get done. And we're all on the same page. Discussion's been elevated. We're ready to get something done.
Mm-hmm. Frank, I want to get well. I want to have you further define that. But what do you see as the starting point? If we are to measure progress going forward on the problem that you and Matt are identifying for us today, what is our starting point? Do you have data?
Oh, there's much data. There is... You know, we've done assessments of the homeless population. There's many anecdotal things that we deal with, but yeah, the data is there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's an ever increasing need for that. The closer we get to realizing opportunities that we have, potential funders are going to say we need data.
Yes,
we are putting pressure on the Indian Health Service in Washington, D.C., and I know that they, in a meeting we had with them recently, expressed the need for us to begin to put that together. We have much, but we will gather much more. We know how it works.
Matt Ohman, can you speak to data, giving us a little sharper picture of the problem that you hope to tackle with this new detox center?
Sure. One of the first efforts of the street project was to do an interview of 100 people on the streets of Sioux City. So there was 100 people that were hanging out in, at shelters and that type of a thing that were interviewed. And that was a project between a couple of our partners, Briarcliff University and Mercy Medical Center. And of those 100 people, one of the things that we found was 47 of them were Native American or identified as Native American. So when you consider that about 2,000 Native Americans live in this community, and over almost half of them, of the people on the streets, are Native American, that's pretty disproportionate. So that is one of the data points that we've really spoke to us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what does that tell you, Matt, about how to tackle this? Obviously, a close partnership with Frank and his connections there.
Absolutely. It's just vital that we have an advocate like Frank involved in these efforts, because he's been, as he said, he's been working with the Native American community for years and years. He's been successful in other communities and engineering some things that have really worked. White clay, he just mentioned. So that just really speaks to us that, you know, this is something about the homeless population, that there's this disproportionate amount of Native Americans that help to populate that it's a pretty dire situation and we need to do something.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this detox center that you hope to build or inhabit in the coming days in Sioux City. Matt, do you have a how far along are you? Let's just put it that way.
Well, right now, ironically, at this very moment, we have another group of people from the street project that are meeting with a potential provider. So we're at the point now where we have an idea of what it is that we want. We have a very tentative budget that has been put together. And so right now we're just trying to find an agency that will step forward and say, we want to run this. And so that's where we're at.
Do you have a location picked out in Sioux City?
We do not have a location yet, but we have several prospective locations.
Mm-hmm. Now you've foreseen, I'm sure, the problem that can arise with such things. I know in areas, homeless shelters and other types of service centers can fall victim to NIMBY, not in my backyard. People generally agree with the fact that this service center needs to be there, but they don't necessarily want it at a certain place. Do you anticipate that, or have you run into that?
Certainly, I think that's a factor in any community. However, one thing that we've been very clear from with the start with this detox center is this is going to be very big with the homeless community. It is going to serve a lot of homeless people, but it is also for everyone. So it would be at a detox center that anyone, no matter what their socioeconomic background is, could go and get some help. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that piece will help with that.
You just joined us. Matt Ohman is with us, Executive Director of the Siouxland Human Investment Partnership, and Frank LeMaire. He's a member of the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska, an advocate for many of the Native peoples living in the Siouxland area. Also, I should mention, Director of Four Directions Community Center of Sioux City. Frank, tell me what you see. Help us picture this detox center. How big would it be? How would it serve people?
Well, you know, we have a lot of ideas on the table right now. I would like to, it would be advantageous if we could put something together that had a dozen beds, if not more. And what we see is we see ourselves connecting with those homeless individuals addicted, in need of detox and even mental health care. We wish to connect with them on the street. We wish to get them detoxed into, you know, many of them are health needs are terrible. We want to get them detoxed, and what we want to do from there that we've not been able to do is we want to take them and coach them, coach them about the need to begin to get well, to heal. And we anticipate that we would immediately get them into a halfway house, or excuse me, into a treatment program, a halfway house. And it's a process that ideally could take a number of months. And what we're looking for in Sioux City that you do not see probably many places, we need a continuum of care. We need local agencies to come out of their silos. I believe in Sioux City. They don't like me to say it, but I will. We have the horses in this community to meet the need. But if I get well, you know, sadly right now, it better be between 8 and 4:30 Monday through Friday, and that's not the way things work. Hmm. But the Native community and the individual wishes to get well, we're going to detox them, and there'll be a continuum of care, and we're not going to detox them in 72 hours and send them back to the same alcohol, drugs, and crippling poverty that brought them to detox. I'm going to say that what we're going to do is we are going to make ourselves uncomfortable. We will make our community and even the agencies uncomfortable. We can do this, but we have never, we're missing. When we have 52% of the homeless people being Native people, and we have more than 50% of arrests in this community for intoxication being Native people, well, we have not addressed that need, or we've not been able to address that need. And that's what we're going to undertake to do, a continuum of care.
Frank, when
and
you say
we have them,
mm-hmm. When you say uncomfortable, make the community there uncomfortable, you mean, it sounds like you mean, just to clarify, that you want people to face the facts here, especially regarding the Native American population.
Oh, absolutely. I think that when we have agencies in town, my God, when we, you know, the people we have who work in the public trust, the private trust, the tribal trust, whose job it is to connect with the folks on the streets of Sioux City and to make them well, if we put them all together, my God, we would not be able to fit them in the office I sit in. But for one reason or another, we're not connecting with them. And that's what we're going to do, is we're going to go back and reassess how we approach that community, the homeless community, not just Natives, but non-Natives also. And we're going to retool. And something that needs to happen, I think, probably in many communities, not just ours. Many communities we travel in are dealing with the same issues. We've undertaken to try to change it because we feel in Woodbury County and Siouxland we're better than this, than to let it go on. When I say uncomfortable, we're going to look at changes, but these are going to be changes even among the agencies, even ourselves. We've got to look at the way we've served this community, because we failed. All of us have, me too. Yeah. And so we're telling that to the community, and the community is agreeing with that, and we'll undertake to try to get the job done.
Matt Ullman, let me follow up with you on that word uncomfortable. It sounds, by the way I hear Frank and you describing this, this is more than a detox center. You're asking your community to rethink a lot of areas about how we treat the homelessness and addiction in the area. So this is a all hands on board, and let's rethink the whole thing.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the key components of this is really going to be care coordination. Care coordination is someone that meets with this population and tries to meet all of their needs, figure out what their needs are, how can we connect you to the services that you need, and then not just send you out the door and say, hey, go down the street, you know, three blocks, and there will be, substance abuse center that you can go to. No, we need to have someone that actually transports people to the places they need to go, because that is a big missing piece. Care coordination is taking them to all of the appointments that they need to go to, making sure they get there, making sure that all their barriers are taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to give someone the help they need if we can't get out of our comfort zone a little bit. And Frank has a really good saying. He says, nothing changes unless people get uncomfortable. And I really love that, and I've kind of co-opted that as well. And I think that's what he's talking about. He says, we have to make ourselves uncomfortable. We have to get out of our comfort zone and do things, to help go that extra mile.
Mm-hmm. Other missing pieces. We haven't talked about funding. Is that, Matt, a missing piece here? Are you seeking funding still?
We absolutely are going to be seeking funding. We have already met with our city council. We've met with our board of supervisors. We've met with the local hospitals. And everyone understands that this is not going to be a service that takes off for free. We're going to have to invest in it as a community. We're looking at, there's a model for a detox center in Rapid City, and we visited Rapid City, and that is a city-county collaboration. There are no federal funds that are going into that. And then private funds as well. We also have an anonymous donor in the community that's ready to step forward and help out to get this thing started. But as a community, it's just vitally important that we all understand this is something that we're going to have to sustain as a community, and we're going to have to invest in it. Uh-huh. So that's where we're at.
You're in the Iowa's 4th District there. Have you been working with Representative Steve King?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What has been the outcome there?
And Frank, I might let you talk about that a little bit, because Frank has really nurtured a relationship with Congressman King.
We have worked very closely with Congressman King's office. We had a meeting with him and officials from the Indian Health Service on June 1st in Sioux City. And I think Congressman King was, very much pleased with the fact that we were able to find buy-in from this community. He even stated to us that there's many projects like that he and I'm sure other leaders across the state, they see these things. And some of them are not successful simply because there's not the collaboration, the buy-in that's needed. I think we've impressed the congressman in that regard. I've been working very closely with his people and helping to formulate strategy, helping to craft questions, letters that we have to the Indian Health Service. He's working mainly to find out what the federal responsibility from the Indian Health Service is. And we're going to exhaust that, and I shouldn't say exhaust that, because I think that the IHS may be a player, may be a partner in this collective effort. And we'll have federal dollars and hopefully private dollars, city dollars, county dollars. We're asking everybody to step up, and Congressman King, in this regard, has done that.
Mm-hmm. State dollars involved, potentially?
Well, I think there's no stone unturned, but, we're looking locally, county, and we're looking at the federal response right now. But I think that when this thing is over and done with, I think there'll be many players at the table that we do not even anticipate yet, and that's good.
Mm-hmm. We have about 5 minutes left in our conversation. I want to get a little better picture of the center. Let's say I am homeless. I have an addiction problem, I guess. How much of an overlap is that among homeless? If you are homeless, the chances that you have a substance abuse problem, Matt, is what?
Pretty great, I would say, and I don't want to throw a number out there, but I would say that many of our homeless population either have a substance abuse problem, mental health issues, or both co-occurring, and that has contributed to them remaining homeless.
Okay, so we have this hopefully future detox center. I assume it's all voluntary. You recruit homeless people from the street. How does that work, Matt?
I think right now the way it works is that we have our police officers who are bumping into these people, and right now their options are, if they're a public intox, is either to take them to the hospital to medically detox or taking them to jail. Neither of those options, the majority of the time, are viable options. So this will give them another option to drop them off at this detox center where they can get the care that they really need.
Mm-hmm. It's a temporary service. You both talk about a continuum here. Have you set down sort of the pipeline, the markers along the road when someone enters the service there, Matt?
It starts with detox, and then after detox, then one of the gaps that we have currently is that typically you'd go into an inpatient service somewhere. Beds are very limited. Spaces are limited. So sometimes when a person is done detoxing, they have to wait. They may have to wait 3 weeks before they get a bed. And in the meantime, they're put right back out in the street. And we all know that if someone needs those services, they need them now. They don't need them 3 weeks from now.
Yeah.
They're not going to stay sober in 3 weeks. They're going to go back out and go back to the same environment they're in before. So part of our plan is with this continuum of care is to have a place for people to stay until beds open up.
Frank, you wanted to get in there.
Absolutely. There's one other thing that in any conversation we've got to have, and we've undertaken to have it in Woodbury County, Iowa. When any of us, in your listeners, in your mind's eye, when you close your eyes and you think about that homeless person in whatever community you come from or Sioux City, I know exactly what you're going to think about. You're going to think about a man. And we've come to know in working with Jackson Recovery, working with the Women and Children Center, good God, we have scores of homeless women and children that we're dealing with. We have undertaken to not let that be lost, and it should not be lost in this discussion. We have people who can wander the streets, and they can sleep outside if they need to, but children cannot. And we have a lot of women, Native and non-Native, in need of detox, in need of a place for their children. We're trying to take all of those issues and deal with them. This isn't your typical approach. Your typical approach is to work with that homeless man. We're dealing a lot even with women. And how seriously we are taking this. I mean, when all else has failed, let's go back and figure out how to connect. If somebody wants to get well, I should be able to make you well. And that's what we're going to get done in Sioux City. And we'll do it.
A couple loose ends here to tie up. Matt, what does the timeline look like potentially? Should funding come through and all the moving parts sync up here?
Well, we want to get this started as soon as possible. So I think as soon as we have a provider lined up, as soon as we have a location lined up, as soon as we get, you know, some of the funding that we need, we're going to try to get this open sooner rather than later because it's needed right now. You know, we had talked about a pretty aggressive timeline, but I would say, you know, we would shoot for maybe the beginning of the new year would be something that we would shoot for. Whether we'd be able to get it done in that amount of time, we're hoping.
Okay. We have to go, but leave us, if you can, with a way people can find out more online, Matt.
You can go to the Siouxland Street Project website. It's on the SHIP website, so siouxlandship.org, and then go to the Street Project tab.
Okay. Matt Oman, Executive Director, Siouxland Human Investment Partnership, Frank Lemaire, a member of the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska and a Native community advocate. Frank and Matt, thank you so much for outlining the picture there in Sioux City and your push for a new detox center. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment after a short break, we'll explore mental health and suicide prevention services by checking in with wellness representatives at each of Iowa's public universities. Did you know that suicide is the second leading cause of death after traffic accidents among college students? We'll explore that. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to tackle this, an investigation. Did you hear this? An investigation by the Associated Press found that many Google services are tracking your location, even when you tell them not to, in your privacy settings. So we're going to talk with cybersecurity expert at ISU, Doug Jacobson. He'll be on the program tomorrow, about how tech companies use your location data, what you can do about it. Also, talk about voting. Are Iowa's voter rolls and voting machines safe from hacking? Tomorrow on the program, sort of a tech review of some of the things that have been in our news. Let's talk about returning to college, as is happening at this time of the year, and mental health in college. The American Psychological Association says a rising number of college students are seeking treatment at campus counseling centers for serious mental health problems. Suicide is the second leading cause of death after traffic accidents among college students. So as the academic year kicks off, we want to explore mental health and suicide prevention services available at the public universities here in Iowa. So to do that, we have a representative from each of the three. Barry Schreier is in our Iowa City studio, director of the University of Iowa Counseling Services, professor of counseling psychology. Barry, welcome back to the
Great
program.
Thanks to be here, Ben.
Brian Nissen is with us, suicide prevention coordinator at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls, in our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how you doing, Ben?
I'm well, thank you. Mark Robarth is with us, Director of Student Wellness at Iowa State University in Ames. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Ben.
I want to go around to each of you and have you give a little outline of what's on your mind when we, you know, when you contemplate the statistics that I said there, and maybe you want to add to that too, so that we have a more complete picture of the mental health profile of a college student, as if maybe we're on a road and we're starting off on our collegiate career. Maybe we're coming back for our second and third year, and we are alerted to the hazards on that road in terms of mental health. What would you put on my road there, Barry Schreier?
Sure. So one of the things I think about is this statistic, which is a sobering statistic, but it also has a shiny side to it, which is data from the Center for Collegiate Mental Health indicates last year that enrollments at university and colleges in the United States is up 5%, and the use of counseling services on those campuses is up 30%. So one of the things we're aware of is that college students in numbers not previously seen in other generations are accessing counseling services.
Mm-hmm.
So the nice thing about that is that students are aware of their mental health. They are self-aware. They are aware of services. They don't bear stigma like my generation did, which is now two generations ago. But they don't bear stigma like my generation did. And so the thing that I'm aware of is that students are very aware of their own mental health, and because of a lot of social media, they're aware of each other's.
Mm-hmm. Brian, that sounds like a good development. It could be interpreted as sort of an outbreak of mental health issues, but if you see it as just more reporting going on, what, you have a Brian, you have a positive a view of that. Do you just see it the same way?
Yes, I agree. I think that students are more connected and are more willing to come forward with their mental health issues and seeking out help.
Mm-hmm. Mark, you have a new wellness center at Iowa State University?
That's correct.
So what will that add to the picture that was missing before?
I think when we think about the mental health issue on our campuses across the country, we have to think about it from the clinical perspective and the treatment that we're providing on our campuses, but we also have to think about it from a holistic well-being end of the spectrum in terms of prevention, education, and outreach. And so student wellness at Iowa State was created in terms of being able to provide that structure to really change our culture on our campus. And that doesn't happen overnight, but it's certainly we have had a lot of great things happening here the last couple of years since we got going. And certainly mental health is a huge part of that. Our National College Health Assessment data in terms of academic impacts impacting college students negatively, the top things really boil down to mental health when you think about stress and anxiety and depression and sleep issues, and they're so interconnected. So I think it's really about helping our students as they navigate the road, as you talked about, Ben, in terms of finding balance and making sure that they have the support they need to be successful while they're with us here in college.
Mm-hmm. Brian, tell us a little bit more about the picture you see there at the University of Northern Iowa. What kind of data can you give us in terms of mental health? How many college students experience sort of serious mental health issues during a four-year term at the university there in Cedar Falls? Fill in some of the blanks for us so we get a better picture of the student body as it pertains to mental health and mental illness.
Well, we serve about 1,000 students every year through our counseling center. And so looking at over 4 years, many of those students continue their services with us. So I don't have a four-year number for you, but we do serve 1,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 1,000 a year, and can you break that out a little bit more into categories? 1,000 a year for what? How serious are we? What type of issues are we dealing with?
Dealing with, obviously, depression and quite a bit of anxiety. Anxiety issues are something that we see quite a bit, and one of the reasons we've started running groups specific to anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Reaching out to our listeners this half hour as we talk about mental health and mental illness in the college years. Join us. Perhaps you can look back on your college years and you've perhaps faced a mental health issue in college. Where did you find help? How did you find help? Barry just described that. Thankfully, that culture, the taboo, the stigma around it has lessened somewhat. Do you have an experience to share with us, or a question to ask. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Barry at the University of Iowa, give us a better picture, sort of the same direction I was going with Brian there. How many students do we think face these mental health challenges during their course or their studies here?
Yeah, my colleague quoted the American College Health Association survey, which the University of Iowa does every year as well. And the statistics are pretty clear. They basically say through self-reporting that a far higher number than even 5 to 10 years ago of students were reporting higher mood concerns, higher anxiety concerns. The thing that I would offer, and I think along the wellness chain that my other colleague talked about, is this critical information. Is we always want to know, like, what are people struggling with and how many students are struggling with mental illness and how many students think about suicide? And the thing we don't talk about a lot, which I think is super critical and it's important for students to hear, is if we look at our data, our outcome data at the University of Iowa, which I assume is similar to a lot of other colleges, about 2/3 of students that come for counseling say that they know that counseling significantly helped them do better interpersonally and academically.
Mm-hmm.
When we ask students their satisfaction with counseling, 90% of the students say that they were highly satisfied to the point that if they were to give a letter grade for their counseling, they would give it an A+.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a really critical piece, is students are struggling for sure. But the additional data we've got to get out there in terms of culture change is to say to students, when you use these services, they work. You get better.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be something as simple as you just need to sleep more.
Right.
There's a lot of data out there that says if our students simply slept better, about 30% of them would stop seeking counseling immediately. They would just feel better and they wouldn't think something was wrong with them. They just are sleep deprived. But what we know is that unequivocally, counseling works. And that's a really important statistic and data piece of data to get out there, is when students come, they get better and they get better quickly. On average, when a student comes for counseling, they come 5.4 times and they're done.
Mm-hmm. Brian, do you see that sort of satisfaction at the University of Northern Iowa?
Yes, we do. Obviously, individuals that seek out help, when we're talking about suicidality, individuals that receive help tend to never go through that again and don't ultimately die by suicide.
Yeah. Now, I suppose, Brian, here when we talk about if there has been, would you agree there's been a lessening of the stigma attached to seeking mental health services, Brian?
Yes, definitely. That's something that has been a huge part of our programming here at the University of Northern Iowa. But there's a lot of work to be done. And it's one of the reasons why college campuses are somewhat safer. If you look at some of the studies that are done, college students have a lower suicide rate than their same age peers that aren't, you know, enrolled in college.
Why would that be, Brian?
Oh, it has a lot to do with the services that are available, just like what we're talking about today. Obviously, the counseling services groups, but also the connectivity, intramurals, being able to be involved, and really that openness and acceptance from their peers.
Right. And I suppose, Mark, there at ISU, some of this depends on, a lot of it depends on identifying at-risk students here, right? I mean, they could be identified by fellow students, by faculty members, by staff, right?
That's absolutely right, Ben. I think about, you know, we've just went through training with a lot of our new incoming student leaders, whether that's community advisors or peer mentors. But it's also about working with our staff and faculty. And certainly for us, as we look at what's on the horizon, it's really making sure that we're equipping everyone, not just mm-hmm. students, but also faculty and staff, with the information that they need to understand the signs and make sure that they're aware of what the resources are on campus. They don't have to be the experts,
right,
but we want to make sure that they feel comfortable if they notice behavior change in a peer, a roommate, or a student. If it's a faculty member in the classroom, we want to make sure they feel comfortable at least reaching out and getting that student connected.
Right, right. Reaching out to that student, because I can imagine you would not want to sort of, I guess, report that student and cause more waves of problems for a student who is obviously still having problems. How do you do that, Mark?
You know, it's really, I often talk about on our campuses, and this has to do, Ben, with a lot of different issues beyond mental health, but how are we creating a culture of care, connectedness, and belongingness. And I think Barry was talking about our National College Health Assessment data, and in the mental health section, you know, it's a high percentage of our students who are self-reporting being lonely, or maybe that they don't feel that they belong. So I think the opportunities we're creating, the resources that we're sharing to really help students be well holistically and be connected with one another or a student organization or in fraternity sorority life, or, you know, there are so many different opportunities. And I think the more we can come at this from a compassionate perspective and help our students in being engaged and connected, that that only helps to grow relationships and being able to make referrals appropriately.
Barry, you jump in on this point here of outreach and connectivity in the campus.
Yeah, so critical. I really appreciate this point. So I belong to a national organization called the Association of University and College Counseling Center Directors, and we're about 900 institutions in the U.S. and across the globe. And so we represent a huge number of campus counseling centers. So we ask directors every year, of the students that you lost on your campus to suicide, how many of them came to the counseling center? And what we find out pretty stably each year is only about 15% of those students ever made contact with the counseling service. So 85% of students who are going to complete suicide on a campus have never made contact with their counseling center. And yet we know a huge number of students who are thinking about suicide talk about it. So if they're not telling people in my office, who are they telling? Well, they're telling the people they know.
Right.
And so the idea of emboldening everyone on campus to do three things. Recognize when a student is in distress and when that student's in front of you, recognize it then. Secondly, lean into that student. When you're having doubt or concern, lean into a student and ask them about themselves and do something more than what I call kind of the Midwest two-step, which is, hi, how are you? Fine, how are you? Fine. And then we both go our opposite
right,
directions.
Yes.
And nobody knows anything about anyone. But ask, lean in and ask that student.
What is an appropriate question? Appropriate.
Well, first of all, it's owning my own perception. Something seems different. I've noticed a change. Is everything okay?
Yeah.
And then be dissatisfied with the first response, which is, I'm fine. And to say,
be dissatisfied with it.
Yes.
Because that's Iowa nice or Midwest nice.
Yep. You don't seem fine. I'm worried about you and I'm concerned and I want you to do well. And then, as my colleague said, your job's not to diagnose or be the expert. Your job is to be aware of resources around you and help connect the student who you're having concerns about with those resources.
Mm, interesting. Brian, what do you have to add to that point or another point? We have about 5 minutes left.
Yeah, that's here at the University of Northern Iowa, we're training as many people as we can in what's called QPR, Question, Persuade, Refer, which does exactly what you're talking about, which is to enable individuals to recognize when somebody's in crisis, when they're showing those signs, because so often those signs are not direct. They're indirect. They're trying to communicate and don't know how to do it. And so being able to have people trained on campus and really educated on what to look for and how to respond with that person to enable them to get to the help they need.
Mm-hmm. We wish it wouldn't happen, but we do lose students to suicide. It seems every year all three of your campuses have lost students to suicide. What happens then? What mode do you move into there, Barry, when that tragedy happens?
Yeah, so the numbers are pretty clear from the CDC, about 7.5 suicides per 100,000. And so if we think simply based on just numbers, we're looking at 2 to 3 suicides a year. Last year.
On the UI campus?
That's right.
Just statistically speaking.
Just numerically speaking. And we often don't hit that, which is good, which talks to me a little bit about our efforts and that they're making a difference. But in the aftermath of such a thing, we think about it in three rings. The first ring is sort of the immediate response, which is those in first-degree relationship to the person that's been lost, which is friends, roommates, organizations the student belongs to, classrooms where students show up at class and now there's an empty seat in the room. We think about second degree, which is associated organizations, associated people. And then a third ring, which is after sort of the hubbub sort of slowly fades away and people get back to the daily living, it's the folks who don't seem to move on. I'm sort of just feel depressed and I don't know why, or I'm not very hungry and I don't know why. And then keeping eyes on those folks and that sort of.
What can you do in that situation? Somebody who's hung up on that. You don't want to forget the person. Certainly, they are a loss in your life and many lives forevermore. But you want to continue your life.
That's right. So we want people to keep up with their daily living, even almost immediately. And it's not a betrayal of the person that you lost. You can do both of those things at the same time, as you can remember and grieve for a lost friend and continue on with your own life. But it's also about connecting people up with services that they need additional support and making sure they turn to their own support networks as well.
Mm-hmm. Mark in Ames, I understand you had an event last spring, Out of the Darkness. What was that about?
Yes, the America Foundation for Suicide Prevention, one of their many efforts is a walk on college campuses that's called Out of the Darkness. And it was actually the first time that different student organizations that focus on topics around mental health, disordered eating, body image, substance abuse, they really came together with the support of our leadership on campus to have this first walk. And I was absolutely blown away, Ben, by what they achieved in terms of the turnout. They raised over $94,000 in their first year of this effort. And it goes back to the previous point that was just being talked about in terms of what happens for students. And it's, to me, about engagement as well. We have so many students who are engaged that have really helped to make a difference on our campus in terms of giving us feedback for those of us that work in health, mental health, wellness, on what they would like to see, what would be helpful for them. But they also want to be involved. They want to help educate their peers. They want to remember a friend or a family member. You know, some of the students have been directly impacted. Some of them have been indirectly impacted. And by that event was a great example, one of many last year, where our students really stepped up and took the lead and just made a huge difference. And so I'm excited to see more of that happen every year here at Iowa State.
Let's see if we can squeeze in one caller before our hour ends. Jeff is calling from Iowa City. Hi, Jeff. I'll have to ask you to make it quick, but we're sure glad you called. Welcome.
Well, hi. I'm a history professor at the University of Iowa. I teach very large undergraduate courses, lecture courses. But I'm just wondering about the sense of isolation among undergraduates that comes from the university policy of encouraging resident students to take online courses.
I see.
Where they don't. And does this increase the sense of isolation among students?
Yeah.
From faculty and students? And does it exacerbate the problem of suicide?
Yeah. Interesting question, Jeff, because online is a growing area of study. Barry, does this increase isolation? Does isolation match up with a problem when it comes to suicide prevention?
For sure. Yeah, I appreciate the question from our professor. Absolutely. The research is getting increasingly clear that screen time is increasing a person's emotional sense of isolation. And while it raises a person's awareness, it doesn't necessarily create any kind of emotional feeling of connection to others.
Okay. Address that, Brian. Are you addressing that at UNI as well? Screen time and these new technologies and fact that you can attend class without being there?
Not directly, but I agree that, I mean, social isolation is definitely a factor that leads towards suicidality.
Right. To talk about, we have just a few seconds left. Mm-hmm. We haven't raised bullying. That can happen. That can result in suicide as well. Mark, what can you add quickly about bullying? That's a facet here, isn't it?
Yeah, there are really so many facets. I mean, when we're talking about mental health issues and suicide, and if you're experiencing bullying, it goes back to that. It's probably pretty hard to feel connected or that you belong. It could be causing stress and anxiety or depression. And so there's so much interconnection, earlier talking about sleep and that connection. And so all of these things can compound and have an impact on someone. And so I think we really have to continue looking at this from a holistic perspective, and bullying is a great example as well.
Yeah, and that connectedness, because when you're being bullied, there's a bullier, there's the victim there, and there are bystanders, and they have to not do something. They have to do something. That's a whole nother show. Perhaps we'll talk about that. We've run out of time. Mark Robarth of Iowa State University, Brian Nissen of the University of Northern Iowa, and Barry Schreier of the University of Iowa. Thanks for helping
us, Ben.
Check in.
Thank you.
Mental
Thank
health
you.
On our university campuses. By the way, National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. If you or someone you know of needs help, here's a number, 1-800-273-8255, 800-273-8255, or go online, suicidepreventionlifeline.org. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.